from KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The stock market has gone up and down at various times over the past 2 years, but generally held strong on the upward trend. Until recently, a confluence of factors, including market instability over President Trump's tariffs on China, finally appears to be taking a toll. A recent survey of business economists found that 74% of them worried there would be a full-blown recession in the U.S. by the end of 2021. But Trump is having none of it, blaming negative media coverage for fueling uncertainty and his own Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. Trump has sold his base the claim that the economy is in excellent health and that it is all because of him. He fears that a crash would deeply hurt his chances of re-election. My guest is Marshall Auerbach, a market analyst and commentator and a regular contributor to Economy for All, a project of the Independent Media Institute. Welcome to the program, Marshall.
Thanks, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
So, of course, we should clarify, and I like to do this every time we talk about the stock market, that the health of the stock market is an indicator of the health of corporate economies and not necessarily the economies of individuals or households, and that it doesn't always translate that way. And so Trump has been making this claim that the economy is doing great, even though income inequality continues to be far too high. Do you feel that the indicators we're seeing right now suggest that the market could indeed crash? Are you in alignment with the 74% of people in the survey I mentioned?
Yeah, well, I tend to think the stock market has very little to do with the real economy right now. To the extent that you have financial accidents that impinge on the real economy, as they did in 2008, that's when they have an impact. But I think now the rest of the time it's just a wealth recycling machine going from one class of investors to another. It's actually exacerbated the inequality problem. It has very little long-term relationship with the economy as such, because I think that executives spend so much time dressing up the quarterly earnings to fatten up the share price and increase their CEO compensation. And it has very little these days to do with the actual health of companies per se, and it doesn't really fulfill its function of providing capital to worthy companies to facilitate growth. It's usually just a means of helping encourage stock buybacks and dividends. So I don't really pay much attention to the gyrations of the stock market on a daily basis anymore.
Trump on Monday, in two tweets, because of course he tends to preside through Twitter, demanded that the Federal Reserve cut its interest rate by a full percentage point over a, quote, fairly short period of time. And, you know, he's basically accused Jerome Powell, he's accused the media, he's accused Democrats of conspiring to ruin the economy, everyone but himself. What do you make of this demand to cut the interest rates, federal interest rates, by a percentage point? Is it, and it seems as though some sectors of the stock market have responded favorably to that.
Yeah, again, it's just juicing up a rather debt-laden economy and an asset bubble. I don't think I've always felt that monetary policy as a means of fixing the economy is actually a rather poor option. It's a bit I liken it to using a scalpel to do surgery, an axe to do surgery. I think that the what you want is a scalpel to do surgery, and that's the role of fiscal policy. So you really need to have measures which put income into the pockets of the average American, and that happens, as I say, through what you do on taxes or governments in spending. And of course, the real problem, and it's something you alluded to before, is that the vast majority of the measures that have been taken, not just under Trump, but I would say under previous presidents as well, is that too many of the benefits have flowed to those at the upper tier and with the highest savings propensity. So that even though we're getting this agglomeration or constellation of very, very solid economic data, the benefits are being restricted to a relatively small tier of the population. And that's why, even though you have, say, low unemployment, why people in general aren't doing as well as they should be, given the official data.
Now, the health of the long-term health of the stock market does have deep consequences on a lot of Americans' retirements, as we saw in the last crash and recession. You know, we tend to have our retirement pension plans embedded in the stock market, invested in the stock market. In 2008, we saw people's retirements wiped out, at least, you know, for those people who are right near retirement and hoping to actually have a nest egg to live on. And so there is, of course, that huge fear among ordinary Americans, even if their day-to-day paycheck isn't dependent on the health of the economy or the stock market, I should say, their retirements, their future is.
Yes, that's true. And I would add to that that many of them, their pension funds have not really recovered, even from the lows of 2008. The nature of the market has changed. The breadth of the recovery has been focused in a relatively small number of sectors. So a lot of people haven't really benefited to the degree that they should. And in addition to that, I would add that, you know, you have a lot of companies where, you know, Americans historically place a portion of their savings. And these companies have fallen prone to the disease of financialization. They've moved from being, say, engineering companies to vast financial engineering enterprises. As an example, I would cite General Electric, which is now increasingly being rumored to be a candidate for bankruptcy. And General Electric used to be a great manufacturing conglomerate that employed millions of Americans. It was a high-growth company and also was a core holding in a number of people's pension funds. And now you're in a situation where previous management basically placed all their bets on GE Capital, which has destroyed the company. They've sold off many of their cash flow positive manufacturing arms, and for what aim? And so your average investor is often left holding a company which has been destroyed by the depredations of financialization.
Now, Trump has talked a lot about saving American corporations and thereby saving American jobs, giving corporations more incentive to keep jobs here in the U.S., and has, you know, used that as a direct way to make the case for his presidency needing to continue. In some regions of the country, some people say that he might have been somewhat successful, but overall, it seems as though he hasn't really fulfilled in that promise, right? Even for companies that have taken huge government subsidies and or tax breaks, they haven't turned around and poured that into job creation.
No, they've, in fact, if you look at the data that's come out for after his corporate tax reform, tax avoidance has actually increased. It hasn't decreased. And the other thing is that the vast majority of that money that was supposedly going to flood into job creating investment activities for companies has largely gone into share buybacks and dividends. That's according to data that's been compiled by a number of journalists who have looked at this. So it's been a situation where, you know, I applaud Trump for not being a fiscal austerity crazy, but the bulk of his fiscal stimulus has been deployed towards the people that least need the help, and that's why it hasn't been particularly effective. In regard to the trade war itself,
yes, let's get to that and the China tariffs.
Yeah, because you mentioned that and The rationale behind those tariffs was to help those people that had been ill-served by the trends in globalization, which left a lot of losers, particularly in parts of the country where he won in 2016. But he's using 19th century style instruments to solve 21st century problems. So he says, for example, that he wants to re-domicile a lot of supply chains that have already moved over to China, bring them back to the United States. And at the same time, he has eviscerated the his Department of Education. He's got someone who hates public education running it. And he has no concept of a national industrial strategy to rebuild American manufacturing dynamism at home. So the tariff is a largely ineffective and outdated tool, which won't really help him achieve his objectives, even though I think he was right to acknowledge that many of the trends of the last 30 years have not been particularly beneficial to a large number of Americans. And that's really one of the reasons why he won in 2016.
Let's talk about whether the tariffs on China are causing the market instability or contributing to the market instability that has led to the slump in, you know, economic indicators like the Dow Jones. Where do you fall on that? Because there seems to be a debate in, you know, among economists and even media commentators about the actual impact of those tariffs.
Yeah, so far I don't think the tariff impact has been that great. Bear in mind that the cost components of a lot of these tariffs is pretty well. It's not a substantial, and it doesn't create a substantial impact on price. You've still got, by and large, fairly frictionless trade. But I think what has happened is that for a long period, people assumed that the tariffs that were being imposed was just a negotiating gambit on the part of Trump, and that he didn't really want to change substantially the existing status quo that we had in terms of our global trading relationships. And I think increasingly people are beginning to see that actually, no, that's not the case. He is a protectionist. He does want to fundamentally alter the trading relationship between the United States and China, and in a way that may not be beneficial to the prominent players that dominate the financial markets on Wall Street. And they are beginning to react more negatively as they see that this thing looks like it is becoming a fundamental structural shift in our trading patterns, as opposed to a tempest in a teapot.
So you're saying that those corporations who rely on supply chains from China are hedging their bets that the threats won't necessarily translate and may eat up any price increases and not pass them on to consumers just yet?
Well, there's two things. One is you notice that when Trump threatened his last round of tariffs, the Chinese immediately responded by devaluing their currency, which is closely pegged against the dollar. So they let it weaken to below 7 against the dollar, and that fall alone offsets some of the proposed impact that the tariffs might have. So that's one thing. The second thing is you've got companies like Apple, as an example, which manufactures a large range of its products in China. So if there is more of a if the trade battle between Washington and Beijing begins to escalate, that's the sort of company that could easily be caught in the crossfire. They could have a lot of their supply chains disrupted, and that could have an adverse impact on their own profitability. So that's one of the things that could be a real problem going forward.
Wasn't that the reason why the last round of tariffs was postponed to after this December, because Apple and companies like them didn't want to have to raise their prices ahead of the holiday shopping season?
Yeah, and that's also an interesting point, because that's the first time that Trump has at least implicitly acknowledged that the tariffs do have an impact on American consumers, that it's American consumers that will pay the price for those tariff increases, as opposed to saying that China is going to pay the price for them. I mean, China is paying the price in the sense that it disrupts their trade channel. They have a trade surplus with the U.S., so of course they will probably be hit disproportionately relative to the U.S., but it does have an impact at home as far as U.S. consumers go as well.
Doesn't it also have a huge impact on the agricultural sector? I mean, we already have a heavily subsidized farm sector, and farmers received government payouts, and over the past year make up for, compensate for their losses of sales to China. Taxpayers have been putting billions of dollars in additional bailout funds to farmers, right?
Yeah, well, they've certainly long benefited from some degree of subsidy, although those have been taken out over the last several decades. It's not as strong as it used to be. But yeah, the U.S. does run a large bilateral trade deficit with China. But historically, one of the balancing items, one of the largest sources of exports going to China has been from the agricultural sector, soybeans, wheat, as two examples. And there, as you say, China has suspended large-scale agricultural purchases. It's directing a lot more of its soybean purchases towards Brazil, for example. And that's a significant market. The U.S. Last year, I think, sold around $30 billion worth of soybeans to the Chinese. So it has a disproportionate impact. And it's ironic because those states are states which went strongly for Trump in 2016. They're red states. So he's not really doing anything at this point to, which is particularly supportive of his base politically.
Now, there's been for years a huge fear among neoliberal economists and the free market capitalists about China becoming the world's dominant economic player, particularly given that trade deficit and this fear that China has much more leverage over the U.S. economy than vice versa. How true is that? And also, today in particular, does China face a vulnerability because of unrest in Hong Kong, which it also is dependent on economically?
Okay, well, those are two separate issues. So I'll take them one at a time. Mm-hmm. In the first instance, I don't think Americans need worry about China superseding them anytime soon as far as being the dominant economic power. I think the world is moving much more towards multipolarity in any case. But China has its own significant challenges to deal with them. It has a capital expenditure bubble equivalent to around 40% of GDP, and that's historically unprecedented. So the Chinese have traditionally, when they produce too much, they've often tried to dump those goods through the export channel, and that channel is being closed off to them. So that creates more domestic pressure at home. And to unwind that without creating a major financial discontinuity is a real problem in China. So that's going to be a challenge. Politically, the country is moving more towards authoritarianism. A lot of the democratic reforms that were introduced by previous leaders in China have been reversed by the current president, Xi Jinping, and that would be okay, except that the economy is also slowing down very rapidly, and the Communist Party's whole grounds for political legitimacy in China rest on it continuing to deliver up rising economic living standards. And if that becomes problematic in any way, then their position becomes threatened as well. So that's another concern that China has. And in this country, a lot of us may not like Trump, but, there's an election coming in another year. He can be voted out of office for all the bad things that people can say about American democracy. It has many problems. Ultimately, you can vote politicians out of office that you don't like. So even with all of its erosions, that's an important difference. And the political institutions are much more stable. Now, as far as Hong Kong goes, that's another challenge for the Chinese leadership because, as you know, there are large-scale protests going on in Hong Kong right now. The causes may not be specifically related to increasing freedoms, but they're protest the Chinese systems, but it's gradually metastasizing into that. Excuse me, there are more and more people who are concerned in Hong Kong that their political liberties have been gradually eroded as time has gone on. This is being increasingly seen as a threat by the Chinese leadership in Beijing. And they're in a very difficult position, because if they try a Tiananmen Square type response, then they'll destroy China as a viable international financial center. And that's historically been a major gateway to the West for them. So that will create another huge amount of damage to them. And that's another vulnerability. And it's one I don't think that the Americans have anything to do with, despite what the Chinese press is saying. But it is something that's going to create huge challenges for them, both economically and politically, in the next several months.
It's interesting what you brought up right there at the very end. A number of left groups here in the U.S. are also claiming that the Hong Kong protests are somehow funded by the U.S. as a way to undermine China. But of course, you know, 1.7 million residents of Hong Kong showed up on Sunday to march in the rain, and they've sustained it for months. It's hard to imagine the U.S. is paying all of those people to destabilize China.
I think that the U.S. has had a very unhealthy history in the past of destabilizing countries it doesn't like through covert action. But as you point out, that there are 1.7 million people out in the protests, and to put that in proportion, if the same number of Americans were to be protesting relative to the overall size of the population, you'd be talking about 75 million people in the streets protesting. Mm. So that's not the sort of thing that could be easily done through, say, covert CIA action or Facebook bots, etc. I lived in Hong Kong when the negotiations were going on, and I just think that there has been this tacit alliance between the oligarch class in Hong Kong and the governing authorities in Beijing. You know, they basically said, you can make as much money as you want, but you're not going to get any kind of real political liberalization. And they've effectively gone along with that, even as the liberties have been more and more eroded and the corruption levels have risen. The problem, of course, is that the vast majority of people aren't really seeing the promised political liberalization that was offered up in the 1997 Accord. And this has become a stress point, which is now being reflected in these demonstrations.
So finally, let's turn back to the U.S. with Trump's fear that, or his unfounded claim that it's the Democrats, it's the fake news media, it's the Federal Reserve Chair that's destabilizing the economy. Do you feel that, if the stock market does crash over the next year and a half, that Trump does lose that credibility that he's built, because he has made very, very strong, very wild claims that the economy is better than it's ever been, and that, you know, African Americans and Latinos are doing better than they've ever done under any president, and that it's all because of him. In a recent speech, he essentially told his base, if you want the economy to stay good, you better vote for me. It was almost a threat.
Yeah.
Not that any of us want the economy to fail just to, ruin his chances of re-election, but he's taking a huge chance.
Yeah, well, Bill Maher, I think, amongst others, has said, if it meant getting rid of Trump, it'd be worthwhile having a recession. No, I agree. Most people don't want to see a recession. But I would look at it this way. His base of support his core of support has consistently been around 35-40%. Let's say 40%, and maybe at its best it's been 44-45%. And that's with an economy that, he himself calls it the greatest in history. Let's even allow that, even though I think that there's a touch of hyperbole there. But even with that level of such a great economy, he's not seeing, you know, approval ratings like, say, in the high 50s, low 60s. You would think that if the economy was as great as he says it is, that you'd have much he'd have much higher approval ratings. Well, he hasn't, and that's partly a structural problem, which is to say that what I alluded to earlier, that you have a profound inequality problem, and more of the gains are being funneled to a smaller number of people. And so the economy isn't growing as efficiently and as broadly as it could be. That's one problem. But the other point, and he recognizes that it is a political risk, is that if we do get a recession in the next year, and that's happening over the course of a presidential election, then he is very politically vulnerable, especially in those Midwestern states, which right. I think gave him his margin of victory. So that is, he recognizes the danger, but true to form, he blames everybody but himself for the problems, you know, whether it's the Fed, the Democrats, you name it, they're responsible, and only our stable genius can solve the problem.
Marshall, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate having you on.
Oh, thank you for having me. Anytime, I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Marshall Auerbach, market analyst and commentator and regular contributor to Economy for All, a project of the Independent Media Institute. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.